You're listening to Time Smart Talk with Steve on News Talk WLOB 1310. Paperback Writer, one of my favorite songs. Well, the gentleman we have now as our guest it would be an insult just to refer to him as a paperback writer. He's one of Maine's great authors, also a journalist. Please welcome Paul Dworn. Hey, Paul.
Thank you. I appreciate being here.
Have you ever been introed with Paperback Writer?
I have not, but I love the song, so...
It's a great song.
Yeah, I mean...
And I'm not sure. I know that you have a series of books, and you're having one that comes out in a few months, and I'm not sure what percent make it to paperback, because they get released in hardback these days, and audio and digital, but I think the theme still counts, Paperback Writer.
Well, most of them are still being sold in paperback. Actually, 100% of my books are being sold in paperback, so...
And how apropos. Why don't we start with, and I'll want to, over the next half hour, really talk about writing and literature and your view on reading and education, that type of thing. But I always like to start with, because I think it's fascinating here in Maine, how people have either come to Maine or how their careers have started in Maine, because we have such a unique place. And in your case, much of what you write is set in either the North Woods or has kind of a backdrop of Maine. So why don't we talk about how you first ended up in Maine, if you grew up in Maine, and we'll go from there.
Well, I'm one of the you know, Franco-Americans whose family came to Maine, you know, a century ago. We ended up in Sanford. I grew up in Scarborough, so I'm a Maine kid. I went to Chevres High School back when it was an all-boys Jesuit high school. We had to wear suits and or jackets and ties, I should say,
right.
Very loosely. And I got a great education at Chevres, and it, you know, sent me to Yale. And when I left Maine to go to college, I was never going to come back. I had no intention. And in fact, from Yale, I went to Hollywood, and I had
literally went to Hollywood.
Went to Hollywood. Yes.
And yeah. Wow. So talk about that a little bit. First of all, you know, in at Yale, it looks like you graduated with a BA in English.
Yep.
So from, you know, at Yale, was writing and literature and English, did you know then that that's what you wanted to do, or it was something that the French lit class was full or something else? Or, what, you know, was that something that as a young kid that you really identified with writing and literature?
No, I always knew that I wanted to be a novelist. But, you know, everybody in my life said, well, it's great that you want to write books, but what are you going to really do for work?
Right.
And that is a really good question to ask any young person who wants to be a writer, because it's difficult to make money writing. And, I didn't have a really good answer for it, to be honest, and that's how I ended up in Hollywood. I went off to become a script reader, which is sort of the entry-level position in the movie business. And it was my bad luck.
At a studio or with an agent or with some?
Well, actually, all of the studios, agents, production companies, they all employ these people. And it was really my bad luck that I ended up there during the first of a couple of writing strikes.
Wow.
And so the whole business shut down while I was out there. So I had this, you know, year in Los Angeles in which I moved furniture and, you know, cold called people hoping to sell them on attending workshops in finance and that sort of thing. And washed up back in Maine despite my best plans.
So it never you never even got a chance to look at scripts, or was it short-lived because of the is most of the writing out there, by the way, unionized? I know that in Hollywood most movie
yes.
production and TV, but is that whole genre of writing kind of locked down where you have to be you know, part of SAG or part of one of the writing unions? You can't just go out and say, I'm Paul, I'm a pretty good writer, let me write. You have to go through...
Yeah. Well, you have to become eventually. You have to become part of the Screenwriters Guild, and you can sell a script cold. But then as part of the process, they will force you to join. So, yes, it's still a very highly unionized industry.
Any interesting stories from Hollywood? I used to live.
Not that I can repeat on a family station here.
I lived out in Laguna Beach out in the 80s, and I still do a lot of work in California. And mm-hmm. in many ways, it's a subculture. In my opinion, it's a group of subcultures. Whereas if California was its own country, it'd be like the fifth largest country in terms of its economy. And Hollywood itself is its own bizarre subculture, right?
It is. And in fact, you know, years later, I actually did write and sell a script which got made. And it is available on Netflix. And as I always tell people, please do not ever watch it.
Well, why don't we identify it so we can make sure they don't stumble upon it?
Okay. If... Perchance. As you're, you know, going through your Netflix queue and you see a movie on there called Drop Dead Sexy, starring Jason Lee and Crispin Glover.
Wow.
Do not watch it.
Okay. Drop Dead Sexy. Jason Lee's a credible actor.
No, he's a good guy.
And
Crispin Glover from the Back to the Future movies.
Right. I'm marking this down.
Yeah, please don't.
Isn't there a famous, Dave Letterman announced that he was retiring next year. He announced that a couple of weeks ago. And when all those stories came out, one of the online news groups published the 10 craziest Dave Letterman interviews of all time. And Crispin Glover was like number one.
I think he was. I think he
karate kicked Dave. And again, it's one of those YouTube things where if you Google Dave Letterman, Crispin Glover, where he went on in whether he was channeling some sort of bizarre character or whether there was some other chemical influence involved, it was bizarro. And then he stood up and did a karate kick. And Dave Letterman, and I don't think he'd ever done it on a show, stood up and said, "Well, that's the end of this segment," and he just went backstage. And it was one of the famous Dave Letterman moments, right? Mm. But he's one of your stars in Drop Dead Sexy.
Yes. Let me say something in fairness to myself. I sold the initial script to the production company that ended up making this movie. And when I sold it, it was called Gory Details. And... was set in Maine. The movie that was filmed ended up being set in Austin, Texas.
Okay.
And it retained exactly one line of my original dialogue. So I'm not sure that I can really take credit or blame for Drop Dead Sexy.
However, I
did take a check from...
you can't take credit or blame, but you can take money.
Exactly.
Because... You know, if the two titles, the original title, Gory Details, and the production title, Drop Dead Sexy, I can see the linkage between the two and how it was a natural title evolution, you know.
Yeah.
You know, you think Gory Details. Well, if I wasn't going to go with Gory Details, what would I go with? Drop Dead Sexy. Well, that's fascinating. So, I mean, just selling a script, just... By the way, we have Paul Dworn here in the studio. Not only is he an accomplished novelist and writer... He is the former editor-in-chief of Down East Magazine for about 8 years. He recently stepped down from day-to-day role last year, and he is still the editor emeritus at Down East. So his imprint and his impact on that iconic Maine publication is still felt. But years ago, I wrote a newspaper column for Knight Ridder Tribune. And to this day... The pain of having editors call me all the time and tell me how I just bungled the English language. And I had this whole colon, semicolon thing, which, and they, you know, they would give me Strunk and White guides to, was it Guides to Style? The Guide to Style. They would literally give me one of those books, or it's more like a pamphlet, like every couple of weeks. So after... after Hollywood,
yes,
and after that, what ended up, you know, you left Maine for fame and glory and for education at Yale, and you went to, what was it that brought you back to our great state?
Poverty.
And this was the place to go to get away from poverty?
This is where my parents were.
Oh, okay.
And very soon after I returned to Maine, I had friends who were still living here, and they said, you know, why don't you come camping with us? It will cheer you up. And so we went on a camping trip, a hiking camping trip to the White Mountains, Grafton Notch State Park, where I was struck by lightning.
Really?
Yes.
Because most radio hosts would just go right past that little anecdote. but I can't. I must ask the follow-up. Please, please do tell the story about how you were struck by lightning.
Yeah, we were camped illegally off of the Appalachian Trail because we were 22 years old and stupid. And
by the way, I was also struck by lightning when I was 22, so I'm going to follow up your story. So if you feel like there's anything you need to embellish, now's the time to do it.
Okay.
Because I'm sure you've told people before when you were hit by lightning and you never had the person say, me too, I'm coming right back at you.
So I have.
Add whatever detail you want.
No, what happened with us was that we were camped in a little clearing in the woods, you know, about 2 miles from the nearest road and about 1,000 feet up, and lightning hit a fir tree. Oof. At the edge of our clearing and blew me off the ground. I had a burn on the side of my body about the size of a quarter, and there were three of us there, and one of my friends was in very, very serious shock. Fluid backed up into his lungs. Oh. And I spent the longest 5 hours of my life trying to take care of him while his brother went down for help. And I was convinced that his brother was going to come back with, you know, EMTs or whatever, and I was going to have to tell him that his brother was dead.
Mm.
And fortunately, that didn't happen. But one of the people that came back 5 hours later, in addition to the brother and the EMTs, was a Maine game warden. And I had dealings with game wardens before as somebody who grew up, you know, fishing and
right.
that sort of thing. But it was probably my most significant first interaction with game wardens. And of course, here I am, somebody now who writes about them. The other thing about this experience was when I came down off the mountain, got out of the hospital after being checked, I went back home and people said, you know, you want to be a writer. Well, finally, you have something to write about.
Yeah.
And I did, and it was published in Downey's Magazine. So the very first thing that I ever published ended up being in a magazine that I ended up editing years later. So life is circular, right?
It is circular, and my hope is that your friends were recovered. Everybody turned out okay?
Yeah, you know, within reason.
Well, my quick story, and we'll let Shani decide who has the most dynamic lightning strike story. 1978, I was in a Mercury Monarch car. I don't know why, but I ended up buying this Mercury Monarch car, and I was 18 or 19. And I was driving my family, my mother, my father, and one of my sisters, down at Walt Disney World. In Walt Disney World, the entrance is not like a driveway. It's like a giant highway that kind of feeds into. And so we're driving into the entrance, and all of a sudden it starts pouring. Everything gets dark. And the radio's on. And it's like, boy, this is, you know, hydroplaning. The car is kind of sloshing through the puddles. And all of a sudden, there was an incredible light. And back then, now most cars, their radio antennas are embedded in the windshield and they're kind of integrated in the car. Back then, it was a long, just metal stick that stood up the radio antenna. And lightning had hit the antenna, melted the top, and literally shut down the car. And the radio was damaged, but other than that, the car later started up. But we all just sat there stunned because, A, we recognized we were hit by lightning, and, B, we were still there. And what everyone says about, you know, if you're in a car and how the rubber, the lightning will pass through and go into the earth where, you know, the negative and the positive energy apparently does something. I missed that science class in high school. I was trying to explain it. I'm like, I'm going down this road of thought, and I'm thinking, that road doesn't lead anywhere for me. But all I know is we were hit by lightning, and in our case, nobody was permanently hurt. But it's something you never forget because the whole car shook, and coming that close to facing your own mortality in such a powerful way is just...
For me, I mean, that was the thing. It happened to me when I was 23, and it did shake my sense of, you know, what life is all about and what my life was going to be. And as I said, it also started my writing career, and because I began to freelance after that and ended up doing a lot of that kind of freelance journalism.
And when we talk about your fifth book coming out soon in the series, you have a group of books with some of the same characters, and I guess you refer to it as the Mike Bowditch series of crime novels, but mm-hmm. it all revolves around a main game warden, right?
Right.
And the game warden who showed up that day, do you know who he was?
Oh, yes.
Did you get his name? So was that part of the story and the impact of...
Well, he ended up becoming... obviously, he was important on that night, but the most interesting, I think, anecdote about him was that years... I'm a registered Maine guide, and I do some fly fishing instruction and take people out and that kind of thing. Not as much as I would like to, because usually I'm behind a computer these days, but when I got my guide's license, the way that it works is that you go face a panel of guides and usually retired game wardens. And in this case, the retired game warden was the warden who had rescued me off of that mountain. And I told him at the beginning of the test, I said, you know, I have to confess something. I'm one of the kids that you rescued. And he said, wasn't that a heck of a night, though? And it was great, actually, having him in the test, because, you know, he had seen me in the worst possible situation and knew that I acted with my head on my shoulders and, did everything responsibly, which is what you want a main guide to do. So he, in his mind, I had already passed the test in real life, you know.
Yeah, that's fascinating. So when you go before the panel,
yep.
Is much of it about your knowledge in terms of geography and topography, or is a lot of it about safety? Is a lot about animal husbandry or treatment of? I mean, what are they looking for to qualify people like yourself who want to be registered as tour guides and that type of thing?
Well, what they do is they give you a written guide first now in a number of different categories: hunting, fishing, sea kayaking, whitewater rafting, that sort of thing. You have to pass those things, and that's a lot of the basic stuff. And then you do an oral test in front of a panel. And, you know, those people are trying to get a measure of your character and get a sense of about whether you're somebody that they would send their own teenager off with, you know, on a hunting trip or a fishing trip or whatever it is. So you need to demonstrate not only that you know how to operate a canoe safely or, you know, use flotation devices or those sorts of things, but, you know, they give you a test about how to find a missing hiker. And there's lots of, it's a very clever test that trips up a lot of people, I'm sure.
Is a lot of it still old school with compasses, or obviously
yes.
Now with GPS technology, many people who are hunting, fishing, and camping, you know, there may not be an active signal, but there may be satellite. So is part of it involved technology now, or is it strictly, you know, the old school approach to, you know, how to survive in the woods?
It's strictly the old school. Because at the end of the day, I mean, that's the thing, is that technology can always fail. And you really need to know how to read a compass and, you know, figure out your way out of some place that, I mean, a lot of the things that we're taught about being lost in the woods, for instance, that, you know, you should always follow water flowing downward is mistaken. Water often flows not to a river that leads you know, to civilization, it can flow down to a remote beaver bog that will get you more lost than you were when you started. So there are a lot of those sorts of basic, old school, common sense pieces of advice that still hold true. And I love nothing better than talking to the old woodsmen of Maine, the old game wardens and trappers and poachers. And
right.
I mean, they certainly know the woods better than most of us ever will.
I haven't done a lot of camping lately, but some of my fondest memories were being in the Boy Scouts. In the Boy Scouts where I grew up outside of Boston, but we used to come to Vermont and Maine for all of our hikes and 50-mile hikes. And, when we talk about Maine's economy, obviously there's some challenges in terms of our economic engine. But, with 35,385 hundred square miles, one of our greatest resources is the state itself, whether it's the rivers, the ponds, the waterways, the ocean. And from your experience as a guide and as somebody who's written about it, you've probably seen some of the most dynamic, fascinating places in the backwoods of Maine.
Oh, that was the great thing about being the editor-in-chief of Down East, which was that I was able to give myself assignments to go to the most interesting places in Maine, So it was like, well, I think Down East needs to do a story about Gulf Haggis. I'm going to assign myself the story. So.
That's fascinating. By the way, we have Paul Dworn here. He is the former editor-in-chief of Down East magazine, iconic magazine here in Maine. He is now the editor emeritus, and he is a full-time author who's coming out with his fifth book, which we'll talk about in a little bit. The new book coming out will be The Bone Orchard. And before I forget, anyone interested in information, he has a very, very detailed website, www.paulpauldoiron.com. All of his information on his other books and all of his books are available online and at bookstores all over the place. So that experience in terms of, by the way, we had, I don't know if you know this particular game warden, but Tim Spar.
Oh, sure.
He was on Northwoods Lawn.
Yes, I don't know him personally, but of course I've watched him.
Right. He came in here. We did an interview with him last year. It was just fascinating. The stories, because I don't think people realize that for day-to-day, people are used to identifying with their local municipality police. They may see state police or county police. But because our state is so big and there's so many natural resources, the game warden department is not only is it large, but they're involved with some really critical areas of helping people. In your case, when you and your friends were struck by lightning, but also maintaining trails, snowmobile trails, hiking trails. And my guess is, since your experience and as a guide, you've had a lot of interactions with game wardens. And what's your feeling in general in terms of their role that they play here in Maine in terms of helping people and protecting space?
Well, it's largely misunderstood what game wardens do. In part, that's because the job is different from state to state. But in Maine, game wardens are fully vested officers of the law, which means that they go to the Maine Criminal Justice Academy alongside the prospective state troopers and deputies and that sort of thing. And then they go to an advanced warden academy in which they learn their own dark arts, in many places in Maine, because it's such a remote state, your game warden is your local law enforcement officer, and he or she is, can ticket you or arrest you for everything from, littering to murder, which is why it was such a great thing for me as a fiction writer to create a character who was a Maine game warden, because I realized that this character could be involved in just about every crime that occurs in the state of Maine, because in real life, Maine game wardens are involved with just about every crime that occurs in the state of Maine.
Well, let's talk about, first, I'd like to talk a little bit about your time at Down East, then talk about your book series. So when, as the editor-in-chief of Down East magazine, and now as the editor emeritus, We had Kathleen Flory here a few months ago, who's now the editor, and I think she's doing a great job. I'm a huge fan of Down East Magazine, not only because of the stories, the presentation, but to me, it's this iconic publication that really personifies Maine. Talk a little bit about your time there in your sense and your role in terms of editor-chief of positioning that. And I think that, you know, also during a period when publications in all types of journalism, whether it's magazine or newspaper, have really suffered from advertising marketplace being really competitive. And so there's a lot of challenges in that field. Down East Magazine, I'm sure, has faced challenges, but it feels like they've weathered the storm because people love the magazine so much. And, you know, if I go into a doctor's office and there's not a Down East Magazine there, I walk out. I figure
that's a good test.
It's a good test. I figure if they're not into it enough to have the best, you know, magazine in Maine there, then they may, who knows what they could do with the stethoscope. So talk about your time there in terms of leading the editorial vision and then the magazine, and how you see Down East really playing a role in Maine in terms of how we, and a lot of the circulation is for people outside of Maine that may visit. So talk about your time at Down East a little bit, if you wouldn't mind.
Oh, absolutely. Down East is about, well, actually this year it turns 60, which is amazing in the history of magazines. Magazines do not turn 60 years old. As I've often remarked, we're about the same age as Playboy and Sports Illustrated. But Down East, I think, has succeeded for a couple of reasons. One is because of the affection that people have for the state of Maine. We know that it's a special place. It's a unique place. And I think Down East editors through the generations have done their best to try to represent that. But the other thing I think that's really key to Down East success is that it is an optimistic magazine. You know, Maine is faced with so many challenges. I mean, we never ignore them in the magazine, you know, whether it's the poverty or drug addiction or whatever it is. I mean, people are surprised sometimes when they read those stories in the magazine. But our view has always been, and of course, Kathleen Flory is now the editor-in-chief, and she should speak for the magazine going forward. But our view, I think, has always been that Maine is a good place. And, you know, there are good people who live here. And the future will be better. And we should celebrate this place. It doesn't mean that you treat it in a Pollyanna way. But what you do is you focus on constructive criticism rather than cynicism and sarcasm and that sort of thing. I think a lot of publications sort of local publications sort of fall into that way of talking about Maine because they, you know, are overly exposed maybe to some of the local issues and things like that and sort of see these things through too narrow a lens and don't realize that in the scheme of things, Maine is a great place to grow up, to raise a family, to live. You know, the FBI actually just to talk about my two sides of my life, the FBI just released the 2012 violent crime statistics. And you go for metropolitan areas and you go down the list and there's probably no place safer to walk on a street than Bangor, Maine.
Right.
Actually. And Portland follows close behind. I mean, you're really hard pressed looking down that list of dozens and dozens of other municipalities to find a place that has a lower crime rate.
I mean, I agree. But as a journalist and with your experience at Down East, why do you think that truth exists or that reality exists? Because I travel all over the country and all over the world. And when I mention to people that I'm from Maine, there's a reaction that I don't think most other places get where, and it's not just the branding, it's not the positioning. There's something genuine where people identify, as you just said, Maine is a unique, special place. I think it has to do with our long heritage of being settled hundreds of years ago. So there's a depth of the roots are deep. I think there's such a varied environment from mountains to ponds to rivers and lakes and the ocean. But a lot of it's credited to the people and the mm-hmm. persona and the kind of the main stock. So why do you think, in your experience, that Maine has that that reaction or that positioning with most people? And I think it's well earned and deserved that we are a special place.
I think it's because Mainers value authenticity. We are one of the older states in the nation, and so that many of the people who live here have been here for generations. I mean, their families have been here for generations, and can recognize when the snake oil salesman comes to town.
Right.
But a lot of other states are still growing and forming, and they're all about the latest, newest, shiniest idea, and which turns out, of course, to be a boondoggle. And so I think that Mainers are collectively we are a fairly wise populace, and I think that we recognize in our communities, maybe most of all, that that people need to be trusted. They need to prove themselves to be trustworthy. And we have a culture here that I think doesn't tolerate phonies. And I think that's probably our greatest strength, is that we can recognize one a mile away. And usually those people don't last here. They realize that, there's other states that maybe are more amenable to their style.
Right, like New Jersey.
I'm not going to say.
I know, you're not going to say. You're more politically
correct. I have to sell books in New Jersey.
It's counterintuitive, but you're more politically correct than I am, and I'm running for office. How backwards is that? I agree with what you just said, but do you think there's also a challenge or a downside to an overly provincial, parochial view on where Maine is the way it's always been, and particularly in terms of economic development? Now in the year 2014, we have a relatively small economic engine here in Maine trying to support and drive a huge infrastructure. And clearly industry has changed, whether it's timber or textile or resource-based, to the new economy being more connected to technology and healthcare and more advanced disciplines that required a different approach to education. And do you think there's a resistance to some of those things that on one hand makes us very authentic and very genuine, but also may have slowed some of our acceptance and our evolution into new economy thinking and practices?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I grew up in Scarborough, and Scarborough today is very different from the Scarborough where I was a kid. It's become much more of the megalopolis, that people talk about, which extends now from Portland, maybe south through Boston and Rhode Island and Connecticut and New York and all the way down. And that's a good thing, actually. I think it's a good thing that Southern Maine is now connected to the rest of the information economy, the biotech economy. We need that. We need that kind of development here. Northern Maine has been reliant forever on an extractive economy, which is to say that you cut timber and you sell it overseas and somebody else turns it into a chair or a house or whatever it is. You quarry limestone and it ends up, making monuments in Washington, D.C., that sort of thing. That kind of economy is very fragile, we're learning, because there are places that do all those things a lot more cheaply than Maine can do them. And if Maine is to have a future that provides people more opportunity, I think we need to see more investment in infrastructure and education and vocational training, those sorts of things. I mean, essentially, you know, you don't want to see all of Maine become like York and Cumberland County, but that, you know, those are the counties right now that are leading the way and bearing the load economically for this state.
No, I agree. I think not only leading the way or bearing the load, but I think the economic reality is that capital, like energy or electricity or lightning, goes in its own path of most efficiency. And so when people talk to me about Maine and why we can't bring more jobs to this place or that place, at the end of the day, I think government plays a very important role in terms of setting policy that allows a fertile environment for investment. But ultimately, there are other variables. And the challenge I see in Maine is for every mile that we have of inefficiency, whether it has to do with delivering health care or education or jobs, we're competing against other areas that have greater efficiency. And the new economic model is about efficiency. The new economic model about phone communication or data or sales, everything happens quicker and faster, more efficiently. In Maine has almost been settled opposite that because 200 years ago, nobody expected trains, planes, fiber optics, or anything else. So local economies were in five-mile radiuses where you had your farm and your tree thing, and I was here, and I sold you this, and then we expanded with roads, and then with planes, and then highways, and interstate commerce, and now with technology playing a role in delivering goods and services. I think that there's some great opportunity for Maine, but we probably need to get on it pretty quick or we're falling behind. Let's talk about, so at Down East, as editor-in-chief, by the way, we have Paul Dworn here, who is the former editor-in-chief of Down East Magazine. He's now the editor emeritus. In 2013, you turned over the reins to Kathleen Fleury, and you started publishing a series of books. What was the decision like to say, well, I'm going from a day job where there's an office, there's a phone, there's support structure, and I'm going to a whole different world of being a novelist? And I'm drawing this picture in my head, and it may not match reality, but you know, I see novelists as being very disciplined. You've had five books, and they've come out on a yearly basis in sequence since your first book came out in the series. Do you have a room? Is it a dark room? Is there, you know, is there a flower in the corner in that you write for 4 to 6 hours a day? Because writing is both artistic, but it's also a very disciplined art where, for all the writers I've ever met, have said you really have to roll up your sleeves and focus on creating story and words. And what was it like when you made the decision to go from being in a business kind of communal environment with a magazine to I'm going to be a novelist and sit in a little room with, and again, it may be a big room, but maybe you can even talk about that transition for you.
Well, it was scary, but I had actually been doing it for a number of years. I had my first book, The Poacher's Son, came out in 2010, and I sold it in 2008. So for a number of years, I had been balancing my two jobs. I was both a full-time novelist, and I was also the editor-in-chief of Down East Magazine and also Down East Books for a while and DownEast.com. So I had been trying to do my best with both responsibilities and learned as a journalist to be very efficient in my use of time as a novelist, which is to say that I didn't sit around waiting for inspiration. If I had a free hour or a free 2 hours, I could sit down and start writing on one of my books or, you know, contributing to one of my books. So I'd been doing this for a number of years, and I finally reached a point, I think, in last year where I realized that the time had come to make a choice, that, you know, I'd been doing these two jobs, and I had been very privileged actually to be at Down East for 15 years and to be editor in chief for 8 years, but that I wanted to see what I could accomplish as a novelist. I've been very fortunate in my life as a novelist. I've won awards. I've been on bestseller lists. But, you know, I'm not Stephen King. And you ought to know where the ceiling is, you know, for your abilities. And so the time had come for me to choose. So I stepped away. I'm still affiliated with the magazine, which is something I'm proud of. But mostly I go. I have a writing studio in Camden that I rent, downtown Camden.
So you don't write in your home. So you separate. Was that a thoughtful part of your process that you didn't want to? Because if you do it in your home, it almost feels like it's either casual or part of day to day life. But if you go to a studio, does it help you with the process?
Yes, I wanted to feel as though I was going to work every day. And, you know, even if it meant instead of commuting to, you know, the Down East office, it meant walking into Camden to go to my writing studio and sitting down there and trying to minimize my distractions and just getting down to work. And, you know, it's good. I've learned a lot of discipline, I think, is when you are a journalist, you do have to learn that discipline because your editors have no patience for a writer who is sitting around sort of waiting for the muse to arrive.
Interesting. Well, let's talk about the series, the Mike Bowditch series. You talked a little bit about your first interaction with a main game warden, and that's a central character in your books. The latest book is looks like it's due to be published on July 15th this summer. That's The Bone Orchard. When you were deciding to write, when you wrote the first book, The Poacher's Son, and then followed up with Trespasser and the other books in the series, were you consciously creating a series based on this character and based on the setting, or was it something that after the first book was well received, you decided to kind of extend the story? And at what point do you decide, based on commercial success or artistic vision, that Mike Bowditch is going to have 10 books, 20 books, or do you go in a different genre, a different realm? And then after that, let's talk about the Bone Orchard, which is the latest book.
Well, when I was writing The Poacher's Son, I had no idea what was going to happen with it. I mean, I was something that I'd always wanted to be a novelist, and it was something that I was working on while I was at Down East. I wasn't the editor-in-chief at that time. But it was in my spare time, and it was a story that I wanted to tell about a part of Maine that I didn't get to write about, frankly, in Down East a whole heck of a lot. My family is from Sanford. We're mill workers. My Maine is largely an inland Maine, not a coastal Maine, even though I grew up on the coast. And so I was doing this for myself for a long time. And eventually I looked at the draft that I had written. I said, you know, this is pretty good. Actually, I should try to do something with this. And I was really fortunate to get a great agent, a literary agent. And she said to me when I sent it to her, she said, you know, this is a great novel. But here's what I want to know before I represent you. Is this the only book you're going to ever write? If so, that's wonderful. You've done a great job. But I'm really interested in representing writers who want to have careers. So do you have other ideas about where this character can go? And actually, during the course of writing the book, I had realized that, yes. In fact, because game wardens are involved in all of these various different crimes throughout Maine, that there was a lot of stories that I could tell and wanted to tell, in fact. So it was she sold me essentially on my first contract as writing a series of books. And so for my first contract was for 3 books, The Poacher's Son and 2 as yet unwritten books, which ended up becoming Trespasser and Bad Little Falls. I subsequently got another contract to write Massacre Pond and The Bone Orchard. And now I have another contract to write 2 more books in the series. So people who like my series will know that it will continue for at least 2 more books.
Wow. And it looks like from the pattern of when they've been published, they about once a year.
Oh, yes. It's got to be once a year.
Once a year to keep the continuity?
Yep.
before we talk about Bone Orchard, which is coming out this summer, which encourage everyone to get, Massacre Pond talks a little bit within the theme about Northwoods National Park. Mm-hmm. We had on Lucas St. Clair a few months ago. His mother is Roxanne Quimby, who's well known as one of Maine's largest landowners. They are trying to get, or they're trying to donate their property to create two separate uses, one a national park and one an open public space where trails and snowmobile trails and hunting can still be done. Both in terms of your writing on the subject and your personal views, mm-hmm. do you have a thought about Northwoods National Park and if that's, in your opinion, a good thing or a bad thing for Maine, and how that played out both in terms of fiction and nonfiction in your thinking?
Sure. I wanted to write about the Northwoods National Park controversy because it was a controversy. And it was a topical subject in Maine that really, I think, exposes the gap between the two Maines. You know, a Maine that looks at tourism as a primary engine of economic development, and you know, a Maine that still is relying on timber harvesting and a lot of the traditional uses. You know, people have asked me, well, how do you stand on a Northwoods National Park? And I said, well, read my book. because it took me a whole book, I think, really, to try to figure it out. And I tried to deal fairly, I think, with arguments for and against it. You know, it's what's interesting whenever you write a book is that people will assume that you have an agenda that you don't necessarily have. I think what Lucas Sinclair is doing right now is a smart move. He does need to reassure people that this is not necessarily a threat to the economy of the Millinocket region. You know, whether or not that's going to succeed or not, I have no idea. Of course, you know, we've also seen the mill up there struggle.
Right.
So it's a really interesting, rich subject of conversation. And I think it's one that's going to be occupying people's attention for a while.
Great. You're listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O, News Talk WLOB, 1310 AM. We have Paul Dworn here in the studio. He is a critically acclaimed author, editor, and registered Maine guide. His website is www.pauldworn.com. That's PAULDOIRON.com. In the next few minutes, let's talk about the book that is coming out, The Bone Orchard, scheduled to be published on July 15th. My guess is when it comes to publishing schedule, it's been done for some time now, and now it's going through the system. Talk a little bit about how this book fits into the series, and without giving away any particular plot lines, but talk a little bit about how this is either the same or different from the other books in what's your Mike Bowditch series of crime novels that really revolve around a Maine game warden.
When I started the Poacher's Son, I wanted just to have my protagonist, Mike Bowditch, be young. He's only 24 years old, and he is damaged and haunted by his upbringing. And I wanted to show in the course of my series the evolution and the maturation of this character. What interested me was this idea is like, how does somebody become a hero? You know, he's a troubled young man. He's brave, but he's also impetuous. He's big-hearted, but he's also quick to anger. How does somebody like that become a person that you admire? And so the series works in this way, which is that Mike takes two steps forward in one book and then one step back. And in The Bone Orchard, what we see is Mike, I think, making a real leap forward and becoming the law enforcement officer that he's always meant to be. But has been held back from being based upon his personal upbringing. And so I think a lot of my longtime readers are going to be really relieved by this book, because they're going to see Mike, you know, being the person that they hoped he would grow into being.
And one of the issues, I think one of the themes is police shootings, civilians. Here in Maine in the last week, there was an incident where it's still under investigation. I think with all fatal shootings in Maine, the Attorney General's office takes over and determines whether or not if it was a lawful act or if it needed to be further investigated. That appears to be also one of the themes in the new book, right? So it's yes. Timely and topical in some ways.
Yeah, I try to always tackle some issue or issues that are, you know, occupying people's attention at the moment. And in this case, there are two. One is that, depending upon how you calculate these things, Maine has more per capita veterans of the Afghan war than any other state. As I say, you know, these things are always up for grabs, how you just define these things. So we have a lot of people who are coming back from Afghanistan and Iraq, and they have been wounded or changed in one way or another. Some of these people are coming back with post-traumatic stress syndrome. As a culture, we haven't really begun to reckon, I think, with that. In this book, I want to talk about that and address it. I also deal with the issue of police shootings. This incident that starts the book is what we call a suicide by cop, in which somebody forces a police officer to end their life because they can't do it themselves. And in this case, in the Bone Orchard, it happens to be a veteran of Afghanistan. So I'm trying to deal with both issues at once. These things are really complicated, and they leave scars on everybody involved. And I think it's rich for fiction.
I think all of your books, but, you know, whether it was, regardless of the subject, the fact that it takes place in Maine, the fact that it's connected to experience and insights that you have personally in terms of the outdoors and fly fishing, I think it's fascinating. And I'd like to have you back, every week, because the hour has just flown by, and wish you the best of luck.
Thank you, Steve.
In terms of the new book. And obviously, before you go out and get the fifth book in the series, you can rush out right now. It's in April, so you have plenty of time to get the first four books in Paul Dworin's series. They're available, obviously, in Amazon and bookstores all over the place. His website is www.paul.dworin.com. You don't want to just get the fifth book and not have the foundation of the other four. And thank you for your work with Down East, too. I think you were a great steward of the magazine, and you're still part of the magazine as an emeritus editor. Kathleen Flory, who is here, I think is doing a great job. And aside from just being a literary publication in Maine, I think it's an important part of our communication to the outside areas, and it reinforces and defines in some ways the feeling and specialness of Maine.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the kind words, and I might take you up on the invitation to come back.
Perfect. You're listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O, News Talk WLOB, 1310 AM.